Okay, y'all can't see this, but Andy and I are fist bumping.
Welcome to We The Podcast, the show about how the people outside of the billionaire and millionaire class, you know, most of us, engage the economy.
Imagine a world in which being sick was a barrier to you getting the help you need to get well. Imagine a world in which having cancer stops somebody from getting treatment for that cancer. The fact is, you don't really need to imagine much, because that was the world before the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. For years, millions of Americans were frightened of two little words, pre-existing conditions. They're the words you didn't want to hear, the words that meant denial, higher prices, prices that you couldn't even afford. Welcome to the world of pre-existing conditions. If you fought cancer, heart disease, or kidney disease, you have a pre-existing condition. If you've ever seen a therapist or a psychiatrist for a mental health disorder, that can count as a pre-existing condition too. Pre-existing conditions can even include acid reflux, sleep apnea, or even acne. As if having acne isn't tough enough already. The list of conditions is so long, almost nobody is left out. Several studies estimate that more than 130 million Americans have a pre-existing condition, and maybe more than that. Before the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, Obamacare as they say, private insurance companies could deny coverage to people with pre-existing conditions, or charge you more for having that condition, or sell you a policy in which the condition of the pre-existing condition simply wasn't covered, though other things were, but your sickness was related to the pre-existing condition. In some states, people with pre-existing conditions couldn't be uninsured completely if they had continuous health coverage. Instead, some states like my state of Minnesota allow sick people to go into high-risk pools. But high-risk pools aren't a good long-term option either. A lot of times, they were incredibly expensive or only covered care that wasn't related to your illness. That's why the Affordable Care Act got rid of them. Under the Affordable Care Act, no insurance company could say, "Today I will cover your broken arm, but tomorrow I won't." Or, "Oops, you got cancer. We are only going to pay for 3 weeks of chemo." Or, quote, "Sorry, I guess you're too expensive. Best of luck." That's what Republicans want to return to with their health care proposal. This is one of the most important fights of a lifetime. It's so important because we all know someone with a pre-existing condition, and maybe we have one ourselves. To get a better understanding of how pre-existing conditions before and after the ACA worked, and what could happen in the future if the Republican proposal to repeal the Affordable Care Act actually works, I talked to Andy Slavitt, the former administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under President Obama.
What are pre-existing conditions? Like, for an example, like, when folks say I have a pre-existing condition, could you give me a sense of the range of what these conditions can be?
It could be anything. I mean, if you took a look at the forms, and they're out there, people have been sending them around to remind people, the form to apply for insurance in 2008, 2009 was hundreds of pages. You had to answer the most evasive questions. Have you ever had a mental health problem? Have you ever had an allergy? Is there a history of cancer in your family? Really, really evasive things. And if you remember, back then, people used to hide their illnesses. They would be scared that their employer would find out and they'd lose their job. They'd be scared that they would be denied health care forever. And, you know, I don't know about your family, but most of our family has a pre-existing condition of some sort. I have one. My wife has one. One of my kids has one. They're just life. You don't go through life without it. So it's almost easier to say what isn't a pre-existing condition. If you've been so blessed that you've never been to the doctor, for anything serious, except for maybe a broken arm, then you may be one of the people that doesn't have a pre-existing condition. But most people, if they think about it, they've got people in their family that have had, that have one.
So how many people, I mean, you know, we've heard different estimates about how many folks in America might have a pre-existing condition. I mean, there are 320 million Americans. How many have a pre-existing condition?
So I think if you exclude seniors.
Okay, that's
right, because then you got about 130 million people is the number that I've seen.
Sure, sure, sure. That's a lot. That's a lot. And, you know, I've heard that pre-existing conditions can be things that are not even really conditions in my sense of the term.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm talking about is like prior, being a prior victim of domestic violence.
Yes.
That's not a medical condition. That's a situation.
Yes.
But I mean, it seems particularly cruel.
Well, if you go back to, what are we trying to create here? Are we trying to create an a system that insurance companies like, or one that people like? If you're going to create one that insurance companies like, well, then you'd allow the insurance company to ask a question that would indicate any kind of reason why you might end up in the hospital. So you'd say, hey, if you've got a history of domestic violence, you may end up with a broken nose. And so that's a very relevant fact. And just to be very, very clear with your listeners, and you know this, of course, and I know this, of course, but for your listeners, what is allowed inside this bill that's in front of the Senate right now is something that would allow a state to waive forever the ability to cover things that would be only treatments for people who had pre-existing conditions. It's a little different than the way that the House fashioned it, but it's nonetheless a way to make sure that insurance companies can do what they'd been doing before 2009. It's just not cover you.
So, in other words, pre-existing conditions were something that insurance companies used to either exclude people entirely, exclude them for the pre-existing condition, or charge them a lot more. The Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, comes along, and what happens?
So the two letters that come before ACA that a lot of people forget about, and they're called PPACA, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Now, the Affordable Care Act is the part we talk about all the time. It's a part that got 20 million people covered and insured and changed a lot of people's lives. It's not perfect, but it's taken a step towards real equal access to care for Americans. The patient protection part is the part for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
If we get our insurance through the job, if we get our insurance from any other way, the patient protection part allows a couple basic things to happen. And let me just go through them. Mm-hmm. The first is that it says, if you have ever had any condition before, it's not the insurance company's business. It's not anybody's business but your own. And when you apply for insurance, you're not even going to be asked. You're going to be priced the same as everybody else. That's one thing it does. The second thing it does is it takes a look at another policy that insurance companies used to have called a lifetime or annual cap. And what that said was, as soon as you spend $1 million in your insurance, you can no longer get insurance. Your insurance ends. And you know who spends $1 million really quickly? A baby born a couple weeks early. A baby born a couple weeks early that's in an incubator can spend $1 million like that. A couple heart surgeries for a child who's born with a heart that's a little too small, and that's gone. They're not insurable the rest of their life. That's the second thing. And the third thing that was a patient protection that I think is so essential, it's this definition of what insurance is and what it covers. And that's called the 10 essential benefits. Now, the 10 essential benefits aren't crazy things. They're things like hospital care, mental health, maternity coverage, doctor's visits, prescription drugs. And the reason that's so important is until you had that, people would buy policies and they would have the feeling of gotcha. Every time they get sick, they'd go use their policy and they'd say, oh, sorry, we only cover 2 mental health visits. Or, oh, sorry, yes, you may have cancer, but we don't cover chemotherapy. And that would happen all the time. You know, if you're out there and you remember before 2009, that's the way the world worked. If not, ask your parents, because undoubtedly that happened to them too.
Incredible. And so the Affordable Care Act changed that prior history. Now, if you have a pre-existing condition, you can get a policy that can cover you on the things that you need covered. And they can't just kick you off after you know, they don't want to pay anymore.
That's right. And I've heard you say this, Keith, which is the Affordable Care Act is not perfect. The Affordable Care Act isn't the ultimate place that a lot of us want to be. But the Affordable Care Act took a step, and I think that's maybe one way to look at it, is it took a step which said, we're going to change the compact with the American family and the American consumer. Because the compact before used to be, hey, your ability to get health care depends upon your income and your health status. What the Affordable Care Act did is it took a step to say, we're going to try to change that so that it doesn't matter what your income is. If you got a lower income, you get a tax credit. It doesn't matter what your health status is because you won't be allowed to be asked. Those are enormous steps. Now, a lot of us say, okay, let's take the next step. Who's to know we're going to end up spending all of our time fighting from taking a step backwards? But that's the really important step the ACA made.
Yeah, and so since we passed that bill, and I was honored to vote for that bill, and you really did tremendous work for our country in administering at CMS. But you know, and I know that ever since we passed it, man, it's been a dogfight every damn day. How many votes, repeal votes? 60?
60.
I lost count. I don't know. But now, the Affordable Care Act, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, thank you for that correction, is actually under real threat.
It is.
Is the product that the Republicans in the House and the Senate, are they rationally related to solving some of the legitimate improvements that might be made, or are they changing that fundamental compact that you just referred to?
Oh, I think they want to change the compact, Keith. I mean, let's start with that, with the history, which you experienced, but maybe a lot of Americans weren't paying attention to. So when the fight against the ACA began was the day it passed. And it, because a bunch of lawyers and lobbyists got in a room and said, we're going to attack every word and every letter of this. Because we don't believe, some of them, they just don't believe in it. I mean, they just don't believe that people should be entitled to have access to health care. And so what they did was they went to the Supreme Court and they convinced the Supreme Court that 19 states, thankfully not Minnesota, 19 states don't offer the Medicaid expansion to their population. They found other things. They took billions of dollars that were designed to make healthcare more affordable, and they stripped it out so that we couldn't spend it. And so when they point to the fact that premiums have gone up in the country, it's, I think they need to look at themselves. And I lived through that. And I'll tell you one other thing, and this is, you'll know what this means. I had 130 OIG and GAO audits being requested by Congress ongoing at any given time.
Tell the folks what those letters stand for.
So the OIG is the Office of the Inspector General, and the GAO is the General Accounting Office from the Congress. And what this means is that congressmen, Republican congressmen and senators sat around and submitted things to them all day long saying, stop CMS from doing this, stop CMS from doing that. So I don't know that people realize that this is not a new thing that the Republicans are now trying to take back from the ACA. To start with, we had years where we were game on war every day. And people like you were such important allies to us during this whole thing. And it was very acrimonious. So we get to this point where, of course, at the same time, they ran elections on how bad Obamacare was. They decided that if people were going to be unhappy with healthcare, they were going to take advantage of it. And so they basically said deductibles are too high, premiums are too high. Isn't that right? Let's get rid of the ACA. So then you look at the bill they produce, okay? And let's take a look at the bill they produce.
Let's talk
about the bill they produced. So generally speaking, if I'm talking to a Democrat is going to be talking about covering more people and making sure people have access to health care. If I'm talking to a Republican, generally speaking, they're going to be talking about how do I make health care more affordable? How do I reduce the cost of health care? Also an important thing.
Yeah, I agree. I actually think that's legit.
This bill does neither. This bill takes healthcare from 20 million plus people, and it makes healthcare way more expensive. And I'll give you just one data point to tell you everything you need to know. If you have an Obamacare policy, under Trump Care, if you buy the same policy and get the exact same things, it will cost you 74% more for the same policy. So we have a law that's been put together, or a bill that's been put together in the back rooms without much of any expertise involved, no open hearings, a rushed process, and it doesn't work. It's half-baked. And so it really violates both the Democratic and Republican principles.
Well, you know, Andy, when we started talking and I said, well, you know, what about this pre-existing condition thing? And you started out by saying, well, it all depends on what your perspective is. Mm-hmm. If you want to cover everybody, and that's the point of the system, then we need to make sure that, you know, pre-existing conditions are not held against people. But if you want to make sure insurance companies get what they want and make a lot of money, then you should give them every chance they can to exclude people or charge them more. I look at the, what are they calling that thing? The American Health Care Act, you know, the Senate and House version.
Yep.
Whether it's good or bad, it also depends upon your perspective, because the one thing it does is it cuts the taxes of very wealthy people.
That's right. That's right. So Warren Buffett, who many know is one of the wealthiest Americans,
yep,
would get a $650,000 tax cut.
Because he just really needs it.
Because he just really needs it. In fact, here's something interesting. If you take the tax cuts that would go to the 400 wealthiest Americans, it would be enough to pay for Medicaid expansion in four large states.
Wow.
So it really does come down to what you just said, which is, what problem do we think we have as a country? If we think the problem we have is that wealthy people pay too much tax, then this is a bill that is really nails it for you. It really does. It hits it out of the park. If you don't think that's our biggest problem, if you think our biggest problem is that we have to make sure we have enough care to keep people healthy in this country, it's pretty astounding. And in order to pay for those tax cuts, you have to take $1 trillion of health care away from the lowest 40% of income earners and give it into those tax cuts. So that's $1 trillion, Keith, and we'll see where that comes out of. That comes from American families. It comes out of local hospitals. It comes from local communities. It comes from the cousin or sister you have that's a nurse or that's a home care attendant. All the money that pays them keeps these people working, keeps people healthy, focuses on people in the lower 40%, goes away. And you have, as you say, these tax cuts, which is a home run if that's what you want.
If that's the goal. That's the goal. You know, you got it done. So you know, you're like a warrior, really a general on the front line of the battle for healthcare for Americans. And, you know, you remember what their earliest complaints were. Their early complaints were, exchanges aren't working and the premiums and deductibles are too high. Death panels. Does the American Health Care Act, Trump Care, solve those problems?
So, no.
In a word,
no. In the last week, I've had the opportunity to engage on cable TV and national radio with some Republicans who are supporters of the bill, and I think it's important that we hear out what their perspectives are.
Yeah, well, it would have been nice. Yeah. You know, I mean, if we'd had a few hearings.
And what the argument that I will generally get is, we don't want people on Medicaid. Medicaid doesn't work. Medicaid's terrible. And I'll tell you, having run the Medicaid program, that's about the most offensive thing I could hear. But I'll put that aside. We can talk about Medicaid if you like. But that's, and so what we want to do is allow people to buy insurance in the private markets from insurance companies. That's the Republican statement. And so what they do in this bill is they take what they believe is a step towards moving people away from Medicaid, which states, if this passes, to be clear, states will be allowed to get rid of their Medicaid program. I don't think people have talked about that enough, to get rid of their Medicaid program and buy private coverage. And my response is always, do you know the private coverage you're allowing people to buy? You're allowing people to buy coverage that is a $6,000 deductible. You're allowing people who make $15,000 a year, which is about the number, to buy insurance that has a $6,000 deductible for premiums they can't afford because you've taken away all of the support. So one of the reasons why they're having so much trouble, it's not just politics. It's not timing. It's not strategy. It's that the bill has mean and hurtful to people, and they're waking up to it.
Trump would agree that it was mean.
It was true. That's true.
So
you know, if you're young and healthy and you're listening to We the Podcast, you may not actually know what Medicaid and Medicare is. I mean, you may confuse the two terms. It's something that grandma needs. Right. I don't know.
It's confusing.
Yeah, but what okay, is it? We'll
sure.
talk about that.
Sure, yeah. So those programs came about 1965. And here's an interesting thing to know. Generally speaking, Medicare covers you when you're 65 and older. Generally speaking, it does other things, but that's generally what it does. Medicaid covers four types of individuals. It covers kids. So half the people in the program are kids, and by extension, pregnant moms mm-hmm. and moms, number one. Number two, it covers people who live with disabilities. 10 million of those in the country, and you know them. You know many of them if you think about it. Everybody knows people living with disabilities.
Sure.
Ask yourself how a mom with a kid in a wheelchair changes them, takes a shower, gets up, goes to work, and has a life. Doesn't matter how much money they make. They could be well into the middle class. They need Medicaid to do that. 10 mm-hmm. million people, a lot of them kids. Third, seniors.
Yep.
So I know this is confusing because we just said that Medicare covers seniors, but one thing Medicare doesn't cover is nursing home care.
Right.
So if there's a 50% likelihood that you or I or anybody else is going to need Medicaid because that's how their nursing home care is paid for. That's the biggest payer of nursing home care. So that's third. And fourth is low-income people.
Yeah.
So let's think about that. Medicare, Medicaid, 1965, is a promise to America that we're going to cover all those folks, people as they age, people as they fall in tough times, people that are in lower income, people who are kids, people who have disabilities. Before 1965, one in three seniors in America lived below the poverty level. And you think about what a dramatic statement that is and where we are today, which is that it's about 1 in 12 seniors lives below the poverty level.
Sure.
We got more work to do. No question about it, but that's enormous progress. So some of us, like you and me and other people we know, look at that and say, why do we want to take a step back? Why do we want to cut Medicaid and the promise of Medicaid right now?
And some people look at that and say, man, that money could be my tax cut.
Yep, that money could be my tax cut. And I think we ought to watch for the buzzwords they use because they don't actually say that usually. Usually what they say is, we need to put more innovation in Medicaid. We need to create more ability for states to be flexible with Medicaid.
Orwellian doublespeak.
Exactly. That's like, Keith, I'm going to put some innovation in your transportation by taking your car. you will get innovative. You'll find new ways to get to work, maybe.
You better find creativity.
but that's not the kind of innovation that anybody
wants. It's kind of like when they say we have to have an adult conversation about Social Security.
Other good language.
That means you're going to cut my Social Security.
That's right. And look, we need to ask ourselves as a country what our priorities are.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think people so admire about you, Congressman, you talk about and put forward our priorities in the face of a lot of people running a lot of different directions. You remind us what we ought to be focused on and what matters to us. And we could build a wall to Mexico.
Good.
That's expensive.
Yeah.
That's expensive, though.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it in the face of other things. And so I for one, you can fight the opioid crisis, which is a third of treatments are covered by are paid for by Medicaid.
Yeah.
Or you can build a wall, or you can do a tax cut. You probably can't do
all of them.
You just have to decide what we want.
So let's talk a little bit more about Medicaid. How many people are served by it? How many people have benefited by
77
Medicaid?
Million people. Wow. It's the largest insurance program in the world.
That's like a lot of people.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
That's a lot of people. And let me tell you something else. And I think this is important for people to understand. And I sometimes hate to bring this up, but I actually think there is a racial component to why people put down Medicaid. I don't know if you agree with that.
No, I actually do. I actually think it's true. I mean, I think if you can convince people that some undeserving other who might also have some high melanin content is benefiting.
Right.
And then you convince people that even though they may benefit from Medicaid too,
Right.
You know, you right. deserve it.
Right.
But those don't.
Exactly. You know, it happens all the time.
It's you know, it's right along with welfare queens and Willie Horton. And,
exactly. You know, so what, is, you know, you're totally right.
Our country has a certain kind of history.
You're totally right. And what I'd like to do is I actually have the statistics for the racial makeup of Medicaid.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So when I'm on public radio in West Virginia or any radio in West Virginia, I make sure to say, by the way, 89% of the people in West Virginia on Medicaid are white.
Yeah.
41% of people across the country on Medicaid are white.
Yeah.
They may not talk about it.
Right.
They may not be in the public discourse.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would like to think that that wouldn't matter. I would like to think that people would not care. But we also know people need to see themselves in these programs.
Sure, they do. And I would like to think everybody loves everybody. And I would think like to think that equality for all is what we have.
And I'd like cue the guitar.
right. But we still live on planet Earth, and people are known to be tribal, and people are known to be uncaring about people they don't see as like themselves. And
stories matter. So this stories is why stories do matter.
And we got to continue to tell that story. And I agree, I'm grateful you raised that issue, because we do have to help Americans stand up for each other regardless of race, understanding that no matter what color we might come in, you know, we're not exempt from being sick or getting hurt or
having a sick kid
or going through tough times. And
yeah,
if we could build some real solidarity as Americans, we could look after each other a little bit better. I think so.
I totally, you know, I actually think health may be the thing that could bring us together, because it is a commonality. Only 12% of Americans want the Senate to pass the bill they have in front of them.
Well, wait. You mean that this bill that they've had 60 votes to somehow build up to, this American Affordable Health Care Act or whatever. No, it's not affordable. Okay, scratch that. The American Health Care Act. It's funny, they don't even try to claim it's affordable.
Right.
You mean to tell me it's not popular?
So this is what's really fascinating, is Democrat, Republican, they shouldn't have to identify what party they're in to know what's good for them and good for their health. As the details become clear, every day, every new poll, it gets lower and lower and lower. It was in the 20s, and it was 17%. Now, 12% of Americans think this is a good idea. And I think it's useful to say to people, you can be in love with Donald Trump. You can be in love with President Obama. You can be in love with Hillary Clinton. It doesn't matter. What matters is, do you want a healthcare system that works for you? Mm-hmm. And if you can appeal to people on that level and get them to drop all of the thing that we've all used to define us now, we are so defined by our politics. And if you can allow them just a little bit of freedom to say, you know what, for this one thing, you don't have to do that. Let's talk about what's good for you. Let's talk about affordable health care, things that keep you well, and things that won't cause you to go bankrupt when you get a medical bill.
Well, let's round out with that. I mean, when you think about what it takes to be in the middle class in the United States today, to be above water, how important is a solid healthcare
program? Let me tell you a story, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
One of the coolest parts of my job when I worked in the Obama administration was every day, the first thing I would do in the morning, I kept an email address to the public, and I would get up and I would get in my email box and I would read emails from Americans. And then, of course, President Obama would occasionally share his letters with us that he got from Americans. And a lot of them had to do with someone whose life was saved from the ACA, and those are really important. But one letter sticks with me, and it was something to this effect. A woman tells a story in this letter or email where her daughter came home from after school, and the mom gives her little after school snack and says to her, "You know, I've decided to let you join the gymnastics team." And her daughter drops what she's doing, runs over to her mom, hugs her, and hugs her repeatedly, and then she stops and says, "But mom, you told me for 3 years I couldn't join the gymnastics team. What's up?" And she said, mommy has insurance now. And that story just so gets to me, because the feeling of being a parent and knowing that your link to the middle class is so tenuous that if your daughter breaks her ankle, you're done. Yeah. And not being able to tell your daughter that, why she can't do what other kids at school are doing. And then all of a sudden, that worry being off your chest, presumably when the ACA went in place forever, that you would never have to think about the pre-existing condition that your daughter might have if she gets hurt, or the medical bill, or any of the other stuff, shows that we're all one medical bill away. The statistics are pretty clear.
Those top 400, they're not one medical bill.
They're not one medical bill away. And maybe some of them are listening to your show, and if so, I didn't mean to exclude you. Yeah. But you have the bankruptcy rate from a medical bill in 2010, which was the leading cause of consumer bankruptcy, is a medical bill, has been cut in half since the ACA started.
Incredible.
So when people tell me the ACA is broken, I say, I dare you to go tell that to those families.
Yeah, well, to the degree that it could be broken, and I agree that it's not broken, they're trying to break it. I mean, could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, doesn't the government have a responsibility to at least faithfully execute the laws of the United States until such time that those laws are changed?
I thought so. See, I came to the government having had a career only in the private sector, but I was really eager to serve. But I didn't know what I was doing. I was first day in, and the Secretary of Health and Human Services, I'm having a conversation with her. Her name is Sylvia Burwell. She's a wonderful lady.
Yeah,
you know,
she's great.
She says to me, or maybe it was a group of us, just always remember who your boss is. And I didn't know who she was. She said, your boss is the American public. Period. You always work for your bosses. And she was basically saying, it's not me, it's not the president, it's not the Congress. They will help you figure out what the American public wants, but it's the needs of the American public. So I will tell you, I naively assumed that when the campaign season was over and Trump administration came in, that despite all the rhetoric, they would feel the weight of what that meant to have, in my case, in my job, 130 million Americans relying on the services that we were providing, and that would overpower whatever political gibberish they were spewing to get elected. And it turned out not to be the case. We ended the year, when we left office, 2016, 4 million new people signed up for the exchanges. They were getting stronger. Insurance companies had to raise their rates, but were now profitable. We were in a situation where insurance companies were ready to expand, profitable, plenty of problems still to deal with, but a strong set of exchanges. The Trump administration, for whatever reason, decided to systematically undermine that progress, and I think we could probably figure out why, and we could talk about that. But what they did, the following. The first thing they did on the first day they came into office is they signed an executive order which said, we're not going to enforce this law. And instantly, all the actuaries and analysts said that jacked up rates for Americans by 20%.
Because you have to price for risk now, right?
Right, right. The second thing they did is, and this really bothered a lot of us, was in the very last week of open enrollment when they were in charge, so the last week in January, it's the week when all the young people sign up. Because young people are procrastinators. They wait to the end. And so we had all of our outreach and marketing targeted for that last week, and they turned it off.
And so they're not trying to do any public education?
No. They lost, and this was money that was already committed. We estimate 500,000 young, healthy people from signing up for the exchanges by their choice. And a lot of us watching this happen just couldn't believe it, because it was just completely irresponsible. And then they've taken further steps, and they get more and more technical in terms of the commitment that they're supposed to be making to helping pay for the things that lower the cost of deductibles for low-income people. And they've been playing games with that, all to the point that insurers have been saying, we're not sure how to participate in a market that this administration won't support. And if we are going to participate, we've got to charge a lot more for the uncertainty. And a study came out which showed that 2/3 of the increase in cost in the exchanges now is due to choices that Trump made. Independent studies are now showing that.
So, in other words, if it ain't broke, break it.
Right. Exactly. When you say the house is on fire, you better not be seen with matches in your hand.
Yeah. And Trump, you know, repeatedly says, oh, it's collapsing, well, he's collapsing it, you know, and it's really, you know, it you don't want to be cynical. You want to hope that people are doing the right thing for the right reason, but it's kind of hard to imagine, I mean, based on the facts, mm-hmm. that he's doing anything other than trying to sabotage the program.
Well, and I have had Republican senators say to me, we don't have a choice but to pass this law because the exchanges are broken or breaking. And when I say to them, you do realize that the president is carrying this action out, part of the response is that it almost doesn't matter because they don't have enough trust that he'll do the right thing. And so what he's essentially done is said, the only way I'll stop doing this is if you pass my law. So it's like a real estate deal of some sort he probably was in years ago where, you know, you set up the stakes. You say, if you do this, or I'll do that, and you, you know, and it's the kind of thing we've seen from him before. The difference is these are people's lives, and this isn't a game.
We're not talking about some building in Manhattan. We're talking about people's lives all over this country. Well, you know, hey, Andy Slavitt, who was the leader of the CMS, a frontline warrior in the fight for health care for all. Just want to say thank you, man, for everything you've done. And you're a son of Minnesota, and that makes all of us particularly proud of you. And just thanks for coming on We the Podcast.
It's important that our healthcare system be focused on actually caring for people, not leaving people out to dry. Many of us don't have the means to jump through hoops and pay extra fees to get basic care, especially if we're already struggling with medical bills. The conversation about pre-existing condition is really a conversation about how we value treating people fairly in America. It's also a conversation about living within an economy that works for everybody. And of course, making sure that healthcare isn't offered to our families and our friends and our neighbors only at the highest possible price. Healthcare, at bottom, is about community and valuing the lives and the futures of our neighbors. We pay in while we are healthy, so we can get a helping hand when we and our loved ones get sick. And that's the bargain. And the reality is, many of us don't think we need healthcare insurance, until we get sick, that is. Some folks say that people should be responsible, personally responsible, for their own fate. But if you have ever had an accident, or if you have ever experienced a chronic condition, access to quality, affordable care means the difference between life and death. Paying your bills on time, or losing everything, maybe even your home, and certainly your financial future. In a way, it says you matter. When you're covered, you got care. When you can go to the doctor, it says that you're a real person and we value you in this society. We are all pitching in because without you and without stability in your life, we know things would be worse for all of us. And we care because we are all in this together. Thankfully, we have folks taking to the streets and organizing, holding town halls, pulling folks together all over this country to make sure that everybody can go to the doctor when they're sick, to make sure people have access to care, and to make sure that if you find yourself fighting cancer, heart disease, asthma, or diabetes, or if you find a loved one in that same condition, that you will not be alone and you will have a community that stands by you. That's what the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act is all about. That is why we say, whether or not you have a pre-existing or not, you are not going to be sent to the cold. And that is why we're standing against the Republican repeal of the Affordable Care Act. For this episode of We the Podcast, this is Keith Ellison, and I'll see you next time. Hey, I need you to do me a favor. Head on over to We The Podcast page on iTunes and rate, review, and subscribe. If you like the podcast, give us a good rating. It'll help us get the word out. This episode of We The Podcast was produced by Abby Shanfield, Isaiah Kirshner-Breen, Sanaf Rahmani, and Brett Morrow. See you next time.